Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with James Gill and Howard Hunter, authors of Tearing Down the Lost Cause, the removal of New Orleans' Confederate statues. So glad to welcome James Gill and Howard Hunter to The Reading Life. James Gill's literary voice is a staple of New Orleans life, thanks to his long career as an editorial columnist for the Times-Picayune and the New Orleans Advocate. He's also the author of Lords of Misrule, Mardi Gras, and the Politics of Race in New Orleans. Howard Hunter, past president of the Louisiana Historical Society, is the academic dean at Metairie Park Country Day School, where he teaches history. In their new book, they wade into the complicated issues of memorialization and public history. It's called Tearing Down the Lost Cause, the Removal of New Orleans Confederate Statues. James, welcome.
Thank you.
Howard, I'm so happy to meet you.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about how the two of you got together and decided to do this work. What was your goal? James, why don't you start?
We happen to patronize the same watering hole in Metairie. So we met in convivial circumstances. And of course, the Confederate statues were in the news a few years ago. And this city was in the forefront of the move to take them down. So we thought we'd look into the background of it all and try to understand what was going on and what was happening, what would happen. And that was how we came to work together on this.
And Howard, what were the challenges for you?
Well, I think the challenges were trying to write a book with somebody who's a superb writer. That was rather daunting, but somehow we worked it out.
James said you were the real historian. Now you said he's the real writer. So.
Well, I think if you read Lords of Misrule, James has done some serious historical writing, and I think there's a tendency to think, well, you know, I did the history, he did the journalism part, when in fact he's done a lot of really good history on the city, and so it was fun to work together.
And you've both seen history unfold. That was maybe the challenge in writing this book, because things were still unfolding in a way. James?
Well, that seems to be an advantage. I mean, this is the book is about ancient history to a large extent, but also what was happening before our very eyes. So we were witness to what we were writing about, which seems to be a great advantage. And to revert to the previous question, I mean, I think we work very well together because we're friends and we have mutual interests, you know. So we didn't divide the labors according to our talents. We just both dived in and collaborated.
Now, what you do in this book is delve into the history of the monuments to Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, P.G.T. Beauregard, and the Liberty Monument, what they meant at the time, what they meant over time, and what they mean in the present, which are very different things. And this is a kind of debate that in our country we're dealing with all the time these days. So talk a little bit about facing that big issue head on, James, which is what you do all the time as a newspaper columnist. But
well, I think the big issue, I mean, is really what's kind of be called the myth of the Lost Cause. And Mayor Landrieu has spoken eloquently about that. I think it's can't be seriously contested that a lot of what we've came to be written about a lost cause was retroactively was indeed make-believe. What wasn't make-believe, what wasn't myth, of course, was the extent of suffering and privation and death caused by the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So there was an institutional memory of that, which helped you understand the passion behind the move to keep them. Remember, there was passion on both sides in this debate. I think what we tried to do is to understand where they were both coming from, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to do that, you have to understand not what the Lost Cause mythology meant to this city, but what the actual experience of the Civil War meant to the people. It impacted so many people, so many families, and even today people have family memories or institutional memories of great loss and suffering. And people lose sight of that in his talk about in the dispute about mythology. People lose sight of the fact that there are some raw feelings involved here on both sides of the issue.
Think about a war where 750,000 Americans die, and that would be the equivalent of 7 million today in our current population.
Right.
So it had to have a similar kind of impact that, for example, what World War I had on France.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about the challenges of New Orleans as a city that is always creating its own myths, you know, and passing them around and trying to live up to them in so many ways, in so many areas of our society.
Well, one of those myths, of course, if it is a myth, one of those you know, persistent stories is that there existed before the Civil War a superior civilization in the South in general and in New Orleans in particular. And one of the things we tried to do here, I think, was to examine to what extent there is truth in that story.
Yeah, I think what the history reveals is that New Orleans really wasn't much of a Confederate city. 40% mm-hmm. of the population were foreign-born, roughly. Of the white population, you know, 20-25% were northern-born.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cosmopolitan, and it was not like other southern cities in that sense. And you had a really organized unionist movement here after federal occupation. And there were a lot of people who were either against secession or were ambivalent and didn't really feel strongly one way or the other. So it wasn't like other southern cities, yet it was in the sense that you had the slave markets here,
mm-hmm.
and a large slave market, largest in the South.
Right. You open this book with an incredibly dramatic scene that is the dedication of the Lee Monument in 1884, which is celebrated with all the pomp and pageantry New Orleans is known for, or was meant to, but then it rained. And so,
washed out.
Yeah, so, and then you contrast that with the statue's removal in 2017, and what a kind of odd affair that was compared to Mayor Landrieu's speech in Gallier Hall. So it's kind of fraught, that statue. It's had some bad luck in its public performances in some ways. So then you turn to the 134 years in between. And how did you decide how to divide this up, how to organize this massive history?
Well, really, they're obviously, I mean, since the focus is on the monuments, I mean, and remember the last of them, Beauregard, was not established until 1915,
mm-hmm.
when Europe, at least, was already fighting World War I. America wasn't ready yet, but Europe was. So the timeline of those monuments' erection and dedication was an obvious framework.
Mm-hmm.
And that enables us to look at things like the Jefferson Davis funeral and so on and so forth.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Gill and Howard Hunter, authors of Tearing Down the Lost Cause, The Removal of New Orleans Confederate Statues. I was fascinated as well to learn about how important women were in this whole effort. You know, I read some of these chapters and I kept thinking back to Alan Gurganis's wonderful book, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, you know. This is a book that's largely populated by white men. You know, you have to just acknowledge that. But there's a whole chapter devoted to one very determined woman, Mrs. Behan,
yeah.
who gives, like, new life to the term First Lady, I think.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that. That was a really great story.
Well, her husband was mayor of the city, and he had surrendered with Lee at Appomattox as a young major. But she was not only responsible for the Jefferson Davis statue here in New Orleans, but also the Jefferson Davis statue in Richmond. She mm-hmm. was the moving force behind that, because she was the national president of the Ladies Confederate Memorial Association. So she was a real mover and shaker, and she was, you know, really intent that the cause her husband fought for was going to live on in history, and this, that this would go down as a noble cause.
Right. And a relentless fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
And besides that, bargaining. She would bargain sculptors down.
Oh,
just,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And the same sculptor who did the Richmond one did the New Orleans one because Doyle raised his price and she wasn't going to put up with that.
Yep. Shrewd bargainer. So
she also forced in the move to keep the textbooks in the schools on the right Confederate
yeah.
track.
Yeah, Ladies Confederate Memorial Association and the United Daughters of the Confederacy were both instrumental in policing textbooks. Mm.
And in action, they at one point wanted to censure children who'd taken part in Lincoln memorials.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Yeah, these children visited Gettysburg, and the word was that they were duped into reciting the Gettysburg Address.
Oh.
So there was a move by the UDC to censure those children.
Amazing.
And, yeah, that was as late as 1929.
Whoa. Now, P.G.T. Beauregard in this narrative is the one figure who seems a little less polarizing than the others. And you draw heavily on conversations with Walter Isaacson, who mm-hmm. who said, you know, that would be one statue he would keep. So talk a little bit about Beauregard, for example.
Well, Beauregard was the rock star of the Confederacy, of course. I mean, he was like a pinup boy. He was handsome, dashing Creole. I mean, part of that myth about the antebellum South, I mean, the flashing Creole of fighting duels and all that sort of stuff, that was Beauregard. Also, as a general, no slouch. I mean, when he was a great general, I think is maybe up to dispute, but he was certainly a good one. And, of course, had a hand in the start of the Civil War. And also, he was a guy who warned about the dangers of not adequately defending the downriver ports.
Right.
Which the feds ran early on, and it led to the occupation of New Orleans in, was it only 10 months after the start of the Civil War in 1862? So that's one of the reasons that New Orleans never was a Confederate city until after the event, mm-hmm. was that it fell so early. And Beauregard was the one who warned of that danger. So also he was, of course, part of the unification movement after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So he was fairly enlightened on racial matters, too, at least afterwards. So I think you have to cut him some slack. He was not a bad guy in the end. But Mayor Landrieu rejected the idea of making exceptions. He didn't want to make any exceptions. You know, they must all go. But I think it's obvious that Beauregard had, A, more connection with the city than the others, and B, more to commend him. So he was a different case. Yeah, no question about it.
And also, the placement of his statue seemed to make a difference to a lot of people as well.
Esplanade was really the last kind of area of the city where you had a critical mass of Creoles.
Mm-hmm.
And Beauregard really represented, you know, we talk about the waning of Creole civilization in New Orleans. And in many ways, Beauregard really represented that, because before the Civil War, you had three tides of Americans coming in, different periods. And then after the Civil War, you had a number of Confederate veterans coming in who were, you know, Anglo-Protestant. So that was ended up being not, you know, part of the Americanization process, really.
Mm-hmm.
So Beauregard at the end of Esplanade, I mean, really represented the waning of the society and this kind of force of Americanization that nobody could keep back.
Now, the Liberty Monument, on the other hand, seemed to be the one about which there was the most agreement
mm-hmm.
that it could go and not be missed.
in enlightened circles, I don't think there was a lot of disagreement about getting rid of the Liberty Monument, but it was, wasn't it protected by a...
Yeah, originally. That's why they, when Bartholomew was mayor, he tried. He had a plan to take it down, but that was prevented because it was under a federal protection order.
Right.
That's back in the... At the time when they passed the nuisance ordinance, which enabled them to remove them back then.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But the Liberty Monument was different in the, insofar as the other people, there's part of the myth is that the Confederate heroes were also American patriots. They conflate the two things. That they were rebels, but for somehow this made them American patriots too. Dubious argument, you know, for anybody. But you couldn't make it at all with the Liberty Monument because that commemorated a putsch. I mean, an armed uprising that killed people in rebellion against the federal government. So you couldn't pretend that was American patriotism in action, you know. So that was certainly impossible to defend. Mm-hmm. Even at the end. I mean, you know, even the forces that wanted, that were against bringing down the Confederate monuments, didn't waste any breath on that one because it was really indefensible. I mean, it was a bloody illegal uprising that killed a lot of people and led nowhere. Well, mm-hmm. I'd not say it led nowhere, but it was, should we say, it was the antithesis of a patriotic gesture.
Right.
Well, and there were all kinds of crazy things written about the Liberty Monument all the way up until the 1970s about how, you know, this was... you know, this wasn't about race. This was about protecting New Orleans from outsiders. Well, the Metropolitan Police were all from New Orleans,
right?
And most of them were you know, sons of immigrants, and most of them were, you know, first generation Americans. And then you had some black members of the Metropolitan Police. These were homegrown people. So this myth about how this was New Orleans was being invaded by outsiders, it's preposterous.
Now, one of the other things you do in this book that is so, it's just fascinating, is you explain the complicated nature of the ownership of these monuments. Who really owns them? Who has a stake in them? And how difficult it is to place them if they're removed? So talk a little bit about that. You seem to like this idea of Jason Barry's of... a forest of ancients in City Park?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they had ideas also to house them at a plantation, didn't they? Which wouldn't really be a very good idea. I mean,
no.
I mean, for obvious reasons. But they're still in limbo. I mean, they're sitting in that warehouse still, and there's no move, as far as I can see, to establish any kind of arrangement to house them.
Yeah.
And some people don't want them. They just don't want them.
No, they don't.
Even people you think might want them.
Well, I mean, you'd think they would put Jefferson Davis over in the Mississippi coast. But now, and of course, the current administration is not concerned about finding a home for them either. So there's no impetus from government to find a solution.
Yeah. But, you know, Mayor Landrieu, or former Mayor Landrieu, said that this was really just about a property dispute, which was kind of interesting, I thought.
That is interesting.
That, you know, what can you put on public property? And, you know, I think, you know, we come down for Jason Barry's Forest of Ancients, where, you know, maybe we could put Beauregard next to André Calleu, who was the great hero of Port Hudson.
And you wrote an op-ed saying that he deserves his own monument in this city.
Yeah, yeah.
We should explain he was a black man.
Yeah. You know, you had a number of, Butler came into the city and recruited a number of regiments, both white and black, who fought for the Union Army. So at battles like Port Hudson, you had this very strange thing of Louisiana troops charging Louisiana troops. Mm-hmm. You know, this notion of a civil war was very real. You know, this idea of a war between the states is kind of absurd when you look at that, what happened.
So how did your thinking evolve as you wrote this book? I mean, did anything change in the way you thought about public statues like this and memorialization?
Me, yes. It was more complex than I ever knew. You know,
really?
You tend to think, I mean, both sides in the dispute seem to think it's cut and dried. I mean, it's obvious they should come down. It's obvious they should not. after working on this for a while, I think, well, it isn't obvious to me at all who is right. I mean, there are, I can see, as I said before, I can see why there's passion on both sides. I think right is on the side of take him down. Mm-hmm. But it's not as clear cut as you might imagine.
Yeah, I thought this was, trying to navigate that gray area was it's hard, but it's a lot more interesting. Mm-hmm. And okay, what are these? What do these mean? And also, ultimately, what does the Civil War mean? We still don't know how to talk about the Civil War. We think of it as a long time ago, but in the historical landscape, it's really not that long ago, and we're still trying to figure it out.
Well, to me, these are kind of like the oldest instances of public history. These are the things we've chosen to make visible mm-hmm. and prominent in our landscapes. And we're starting to look at all of public history now. Like, what does it mean? Look at the Whitney Plantation. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. That's an entirely new way of telling a very public history. What does it mean that Angola, for example, has a gift shop? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a book coming out called How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith that talks about what it means when you go to all these sites mm-hmm. and they are giving you a version of their institutional history. So these were the very beginning of that, I think. How did mm-hmm. we choose to emphasize our past, elements of our past?
And also, I think it's fair to say that elites in New Orleans tended to support the Confederacy, and it was the elites who created this kind of civic ideology, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it blended very nicely with the romance of Mardi Gras.
The myth of the city, as always.
Yeah.
But also, it seems to me, made Jim Crow easier, too. I mean, I think the mindset behind all this stuff is also the mindset that gave us Jim Crow. I mean,
right.
After all, that lasted well into our lifetimes, this whole thing. So the impact of this and the impact on the mindset behind this was visible to all of us in our lifetimes, too. It seems to me that that's another reason that it matters.
What did you want people to take away from this book? You know people will read it.
Well, that's certainly our hope.
We hope. I want people to experience the complexity of this whole issue. And perhaps this is an example of when we read history, not to be afraid of complexity, embrace complexity, and because it's much more interesting. Think about what history can teach us and why it matters.
And you also included Mayor Landrieu's complete speech.
Yeah,
and
a good one.
And a lengthy, it was mm-hmm. a very good one, and a lengthy interview with him as well. So, James, what do you want people to take away from this book?
Well, I think all books, whatever their intention, I mean, I think the first thing you need to be is you need to tell a good story. Mm-hmm. It's got to be a story that people are interested to read. I think that should always be your high on your list of things to do. I want people to be interested in reading what it was like when they put Beauregard up, or what it was like when they buried Jefferson Davis and dug him up. It seems to me that's obviously at its best, history is a story that absorbs. Mm-hmm. That is what you aim to do.
Yeah. And you both put us right smack dab in the middle of it. It's really a pleasure to read. And it gives you a lot to think about, too.
Thank you.
We've been talking with James Gill and Howard Hunter, whose new book is Tearing Down the Lost Cause, The Removal of New Orleans Confederate Statues. You can meet them when they appear in a virtual event Tuesday, June 22nd from 6 to 7, sponsored by Octavia Books. More info, octaviabooks.com. James, Howard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Casey McQuiston appears in a virtual presentation for her new book, One Last Stop, Friday, June 18th at 6, info@octaviabooks.com. Alex Jennings is the guest for Garden District Bookshop's virtual happy hour, Monday, June 21st at 5 on Facebook Live. The Garden District Bookshop and the Broad Theater host an evening celebrating the national release of the book, Deep Delta Justice by Matthew Van Meter, and the documentary feature A Crime on the Bayou from Shout Studios. That's Monday, June 21st. Matthew Van Meter signs his books from 6 to 7. Screening begins at 7. Tickets at GardenDistrictBookshop.com. James Gill and Howard Hunter discuss and sign Tearing Down the Lost Cause, the removal of New Orleans Confederate statues, Tuesday, June 22nd from 6 to 7 at Octavia Books. Ashley Oliphant and Beth Yarbrough discuss and sign Jean Lafitte Revealed, Thursday, June 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Mark F. Bielski discusses and signs A Mortal Blow to the Confederacy, The Rise and Fall of New Orleans, 1862. That's Thursday, June 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. One Book, One New Orleans has narrowed down the shortlist for 2022, and readers are invited to vote for their selections by July 25th. The choices are I Am New Orleans, edited by Kalamu Yassalam, The Big Door Prize by M.O. Walsh, and I Feel to Believe by Jarvis DeBerry. Check out the One Book, One New Orleans Facebook page. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.